episode.
Hello and welcome back to the podcast. This week's episode is sponsored by Fujifilm. Now this week we're back to another great episode where we have a special guest. I'm not going to try and say his name as I'll let him do it later because it is more complicated than my surname. But he is known to everybody in the industry as LS Digi. And again, we won't go into too much detail here, but this is the guy who made me able to tether all my cameras with the right settings. You can buy your tether tools and tether cables. When I say tether tools, I don't mean the brand tether tools, I mean tools of the tethering light. And he's also the person that you do not upgrade anything until on his Instagram he says, "We're good to go, guys. The new Capture One's working. We're good to go, guys. The new Mac OS no longer has any conflicts with any of the software we need to use."
Yeah.
Like he is that guy. He is that. He is the
guru.
The guru of digi-teching in the industry. And yeah, we are very grateful for him and really grateful that he's agreed to come on the podcast, which I'm very pleased with. I bought some cables from him a while ago, and it's when I'd got the new Fujifilm, and I was like, he was like, "Oh, do you know the best settings?" I was like, "No, I do not." So he spent the time for no financial gain of his own, already bought the cables, to talk me through exactly what the best setup was with the Fujifilm to get the best sort of tethering.
And I remember, and he was the guy that debunked the myth that you can charge and tether at the same time.
Yep, do not charge. We'll ask him about that. We'll get that in there. But yeah, let's dive into the interview and then we'll have a word from our sponsor, Fujifilm.
And today's sponsor is Fujifilm. As you know, the Fujifilm GFX system is my camera of choice and has been all year. We use it for the larger than full frame sensor, the great color depth and the usability. It's been a great asset to have those 100 megapixels on set, especially for post-production and commercial work. The other amazing benefit of the Fujifilm system is the colors. I've been using Velvia in recent months, and just to have that starting point before you go into post-production is so useful. And it just makes so much sense to me coming from like a film stock background of going, yes, this is what we want. We want the saturation. We want the detail, the smooth tonality. Velvia is obviously the choice for me. And of course, you can choose from any of their famous film stocks from back in the day and have that brought directly into your digital camera.
So I've already butchered your name on the intro here and absolutely bailed out by giving your Instagram handle as LS Digi, which is much more easy to pronounce. But would you mind introducing yourself and what it is you do for a job?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Limonus, and I run a company called LS Digi. So I sort of do three things. For the last 15 years, I've been a stills digital tech. And throughout my journey, I've kind of ventured into slightly different routes. So I started designing products, 3D printing, which then went much bigger than I kind of anticipated. And it went into like CNC machining and, you know, different products and stuff. And I also work as a DIT on commercial video sets.
So for those who don't know, which is something I certainly didn't know on my first shoot, what is a Digitech or DIT? What is it you do? Why are you on set on photo shoots?
I guess, yeah, I mean, both of the roles are almost exactly opposites. I mean, it's almost the same role for two different markets, really. I mean, as a stills tech, I mean, my job is to just is responsible for anything digital. So basically, making sure the cameras are functioning right, the settings are correct. Obviously, running Capture One as well, focus checking, backing up files, color grading, dealing with clients, doing on-set comps, for example. And fixing anything that's digital, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, so I remember the first big ad campaign I shot with the full crew, and I was brought on by my producer, and they're like, "I can't remember who the Digitech was, actually," which is annoying. And they're like, "Oh, this is your Digitech for the day." And this guy just walked up to me, took the bag from my hand, and went, "Hey, how's it going?" Opened up my camera bag and started setting up my cameras. And I was like, "Who is this guy? What is this? Like, is he gonna what's going on? Like, am I supposed to be doing this?"
And is he going to take the pictures?
Yeah, well, he did as well because it was still live. So.
Yes, come on, Kay. I mean, that's the funny thing as well, isn't it? Yeah.
It's something I didn't know I needed until I had it.
And you must see a magnitude of sins by photographers. But I remember at one point I was taking a picture and he just came over to me and went, "You do know your label's not in focus, don't you?" And I was like, "I did not." No, I did not. So what are the, like, well, the issues that you try and resolve for us as photographers? What is it that we do that you go, maybe don't do it that way?
I mean, you've kind of described a perfect example. I mean, focus is probably one of the biggest things. I mean, now we're in mirrorless world, it's become much less of an issue. I mean, going back years where we were shooting with, you know, phase ones and Canon, you know, 5D Mark ones or whatever, you know, the focus was off a lot. And it was kind of our job as we were, you know, shooting tethered to quickly, you know, call out if it's, you know, soft, if the focus is behind, if it's back focusing. Sometimes it can be, you know, not even the photographer's fault. Like I've done shoots on phase cameras, which were 5 meters behind every time. And it's because, you know, somebody who hired the camera before has set up, changed settings on the camera to like go behind or go forward. So you suddenly have to troubleshoot it and make sure that it's right. Because otherwise, I think it was a Man United campaign and we were like, the football is not in shot. so I think we need that. And, you know, I jump on the camera, I take a picture. I'm like, yeah, it's not the photographer. It's absolutely the camera. I think it was called focus trim. I think that was the magic setting that was very incorrect. And then I quickly had to tune it to, I think, can't remember who it was, Rooney or somebody was on waiting to be shot. But yeah, so that happens to us. So yeah.
I was going to say, a lot of the times, like the kit that when I turn up on a shoot, I might be shooting a camera I've never used before. And even if it's a camera I've used before, it's not the camera I've used before. It can be any, like, whoever had it last. And there's little things like they could have dropped a lens. Like the sensor could be out of alignment. They could have, like you said, I had it once where someone had put some like bracketing thing on it. I took a photograph and it takes like 6 frames. I'm like, what's going on? It's like,
this is a stop under, this is a stop over. Yeah. What's going on?
But then, like, you know, and of course, a photographer can do everything. They can sort the camera out. But whilst you've got a talent there, like you say, Rooney, they don't want to be waiting for one person to light the set, back up the files, check the focus. Like, there's a scale of efficiency as well. You know,
I think when you go on to bigger commercial jobs, I think there is so much pressure on photographers because it's not just about taking a photo. You know, you've got an art director behind you wanting one thing. You might have a client behind you wanting a different thing and then somebody else. And there's like, you know, a lot of politics going on, a lot of pressure, you know, so many people to manage as well. So I think, you know, that's why it's probably beneficial for the larger jobs to have a digi, to have, you know, a first lighting assistant, a gaffer, or, you know, sparks, depending, you know, how you shoot and stuff, you know, just to ease the pressure off so you can kind of focus on taking the photos.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, composing, thinking about the story or whatever it is.
Exactly. And I think people don't realize coming into it how difficult that side of being a photographer is. Because I remember on a shoot a couple of years ago, I was standing there, I'd got my camera and I just handed it to the, I was like, the camera's not working, like in quite a rude way. I was like so stressed. And the guy was like, there's no battery in it. And of course, I know the camera needs a battery, but when your brain's like, you've got a client going nuts at the art director and the art director's going, but this is not what we've signed off. And then my agent's standing there as well. And they're going, hang on, this is not what we've, and I'm just sitting there going, I just need to take a picture. Yeah. And I'm pressing the button and it's not working. Or, you know, sometimes I've accidentally left a manual focus, a macro lens in autofocus. And it's just hunting. Like, I'm like, why? Yeah. And then the Digitech's always calm and collected. And they're like, there you go. that will do it. Try turning it on. It'll be
I mean, I guess that's kind of our job really, is to subtly help you. And I think, I guess the key word is probably being quite subtle about it as well, because, you know, you don't want to scream. I mean, I have different kinds of photographers. Some photographers want me to shout out if it's out of focus, and then some don't even want me to tell them because they just know. And if there's a couple of pictures out of focus, they don't care.
Yeah.
They'll take another one that will be in. It's like, you know, I know those guys now, you know, so that's, I think, why when you work with people a few times, you sort of learn, because everyone is so different. Every photographer is, you know, completely different from one another. And, you know, the way they shoot, the way they communicate, and you just have to learn, you know, and then sort of identify personalities and styles kind of as you get on the job.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, like, when we have smaller budget jobs, I often choose a digi over an assistant. I don't know what other people, but I'd rather move the lights and not have the pressure of file management. That might say more about my skill set than anything else, but like, I'd rather be physically exhausted than mentally drained from going, you know, because everyone's like, well, you should know whether your photo's in focus or not. It's like, yeah, try juggling clients and, you know, you've got all this input coming in and you just forget to check. Like, it's the easiest thing to forget to check, but the most important thing. And
yes.
Yeah, it's such an important job on set. And the backups, I mean, we'll get into backing up in a bit, but like the backups, do you feel a lot of pressure on that? Like making is it stressful or?
It's funny you say that. I mean, like I said, it's been 15 years, but I am still just as careful with backups as I was when I was starting out. Like, I will look at my Chronosync windows every single time before I click the sync button, because in my head, maybe I went to the toilet, I came back, somebody could have clicked left to right, right to left. There's this button, which basically can mean you can wipe a shoe.
Yeah.
Essentially, right? And I've heard of that happening, genuinely, like very big.
I know it's happened, yeah.
So it's things like this which I try to always not to become too comfortable in my role, I think, and just be like, is this, even when it comes to, you know, adding like favorites into Capture One folders and making sure that, you know, the destination matches and everything else, like this sort of stuff, because you could easily lose images. And when you're on a big commercial job, which could have, you know, costed hundreds of thousands of pounds, you can't make mistakes. You have to be totally on it.
Yeah. And I'd imagine, well, I know, because I've got a friend who's a digi as well. It is incredibly draining by the end of the day. Like, by the time you finished, I mean, he looks a wreck when he's on a job with me. Maybe it's just being around me for the day, but like, he's like, I'm so tired. And I'm like, you've been sitting down all day, mate. What are you on about?
I know what you mean. Sometimes I do think that, you know, I used to do lighting and I feel like I was a lot less tired.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really funny. It is quite mentally exhaustive, I guess. I don't really think about that anymore, but I often feel tired.
Just become the norm.
Now I can put the two and two together.
Yes, no, absolutely. So how did you, or how does somebody end up in your job? Because it's not like you went to the careers counselor at school and they went, do you know what? Digitech, that's the one for you. Like, go and digi some
shoots. Hilarious. It wasn't a million miles away. So.
Really?
Not a Digitech, though. I mean, I moved to England in 2002, I think, when I was 12 or so. And I couldn't speak English at all. It was kind of hilarious. I joined school and eventually I think I was in year 11. And we had one of those like career meetings where it was like, hey, fill in this form and see what kind of a job you could do. And one of the suggestions was photography. So I think I did this one day work experience in a photo studio in Preston, which was a very weird experience, but it was like, you know, I didn't know anything about photography. I was super young and clueless. But eventually, you know, it led me to studying photography in college. Then I did a 3-year degree in Blackpool University, graduated, moved to London, fully thinking that I was going to become a photographer. Like, I had no idea what a Digitech was. I just started assisting. And, you know, initially it was just kind of carrying bags for, you know, £60 a day or something like that. And then, you know, eventually you're like setting up lights, you become a lighting assistant. And more, I think I started seeing that there was like a bigger, you know, the role of managing files was becoming more important. I mean, this is kind of early, not super early digi, but it was kind of... And I sort of realized that my skills, I mean, I was always into computers, always into, you know, building computers from when I was really young. I mean, my brother kind of did that as well. So I think I did it too. And I was always super techie. So I was like, hey, hold on, this kind of suits me. Cause I'm not a person that's like super confident, really good at interacting with people. I think I kind of lost a lot of that confidence when they came to England because of the whole language barrier.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like a whole reset. I was like, oh my God, what's going on? This is, you know, crazy. And I found that like my technical skills were kind of more suited to being a digi rather than a photographer. I mean, I could take a good photo. I knew everything technically, but I just, from assisting photographers, I just found that it's so important the way that you communicate with clients, the way that you pitch yourself, you know, how you interact in meetings, how you interact with models. And I was like observing these photographers who were just amazing at that. And I was like, you know what? I don't think it's me. And I think that's when it kind of clicked that being a photographer might not be my calling. And I was like, you know what? Maybe it's okay. I can focus on something else. And that's how I sort of put my attention into becoming a sort of full-time digi only assistant.
Yeah, cause I was going to ask you, did you do photography first? But obviously, yes, you did. Because I imagine you'd have to have a knowledge of the industry, wouldn't you? You wouldn't be able to come into it blind, I don't think, easily, having not been a photographer or a videographer.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. But I mean, like looking back on it, I kind of wish that I knew a bit more coming out of university. Because, I mean, I spent 3 years shooting stuff on 10.8 film and 5.4 and these like crazy conceptual series like landscapes and architectural series. And when I left, my portfolio was like, what am I going to do with this? I was thinking, okay, what can pay me? How can I earn money from this? I mean, books? Nope, I can't make a book. So it was a bit of a confusing time. So I suddenly had to sort of reinvent myself and sort of figure out, you know, wow, this is the real world. You know, you actually need to make a living in London, you know, paying the rent, everything else. It's very different. I'm like, I wasn't prepared for this.
Yeah, I definitely felt underprepared when I left university. I was like, hang on a second.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how long from going, I'm going to get into this like digi sort of world until having a sustainable income? How long did that take from going, this is what I think I'm going to go and do, to going, oh, it's working? What was that like?
It took a couple of years. I mean, when I moved to London initially, I probably spent like 9 months trying to, you know, assist, shoot, and it didn't go well. I kind of ended up kind of going into debt, actually. You know, we moved back to my mum's house in Preston, and I was actually like catching the 2 a.m. mega bus into London Victoria like 3-4 times a week to go into London, do a day of assisting, catch the last bus back into Preston. And after 6 months, you know, weirdly, something aligned. I got a few more clients, few bigger jobs, and I recovered and moved back into London. So it was a real, real struggle starting out because I didn't have any kind of, you know, help, financial help, you know, parents living in London or friends that I can crash out on, you know. So it was really tricky starting out. But then within a couple of years, I was sort of getting a bit more known, I guess, you know. The more you work, the more people you meet, the more you get recommended. And back then it was a lot of emailing, calling people, agencies, you know, being ignored. It was just, you know, every day. But eventually, I mean, now I don't really do any kind of marketing emails or anything else. I mean, it's a really, I guess, quite a nice position to finally be in.
Yeah, but it doesn't happen. Like everyone assumes, like, oh, you're doing what you're doing now. You must have always been doing that. But I mean, I remember the megabus days because I'm from out of London as well. So it's 150 quid on the train or £5 on a bus at like 2 a.m. Let's get the £5. And you're absolutely broken by the end of the day. Like, and starving as well because you didn't want to spend your wages on lunch. It's like, like dinner on the way home. It's like, no, I'll wait till I get home and I'll have like beans on toast. It was I don't think many people make it through that like 2 year stint though. I think a lot of people start and go, no, this is too hard to get a job.
It's yeah, you're right, because when I look back on my fellow students from my year, we had over 30 students. I think there's maybe three or four that I know that are kind of working in the industry in photography. So yeah, not many do make it in the end.
Yeah, and I think it's the same for digis, for editors, for whatever it is. There is that horrible period where you're living below student lifestyle, working considerably harder than students. It's brutal. I think everyone has to go, well, not everyone has to go through it. If you've got rich parents, you're sorted, but the majority of us have to go through it.
Yes.
What was your first digi setup that you owned? Because obviously, people won't know this actually. When you hire a digi, you can either hire the human being or you can hire the human being and the kit. Because sometimes the kit comes from the rental house. We always try and make it that our digi, if they have kit, can rent it to us, because it makes no difference to me. But obviously for them, it's a great bonus. Rather than the rental house getting it. But what was your first ever digi setup? What were you rocking at the beginning?
I mean, probably the first thing that I bought was a MacBook Pro. And I can't remember which model it was exactly, but 15-inch MacBook Pro i7? No, that must have been, that's probably way later. That was kind of the first thing that I ever bought. And, you know, back then, it was much more common to rent from the rental house, or the photographer will have a computer that you use on. So back then, there weren't many digis, if any, that I knew of, that only came with their kit, for example. Now things are very different. I think most digis now kind of operate with their equipment only. You know, when I come on set, all of my, you know, computer screens are usually the ones that I provide. Whereas back then it was either a mixture or a rental house. It's kind of changed throughout the years now.
And then what cameras were people using back then? What was the mainstays in photography when you were starting out? I bet that's changed a lot.
So yeah, on bigger jobs, I mean, P25, P45s for the phases. I mean, the FireWire 800 cameras, that was like a big job. It was like the cool camera.
Yeah.
Canon 5Ds, I think, were like really, really popular. Some Nikons, maybe. Mainly I see between the three brands, I think they were kind of holding a monopoly.
Yes.
At that time.
Yeah. So when I first got into it, my friend had a Hasselblad with a P25 plus back. And he let me borrow it for magazine shoots sometimes. And I was like, that CCD sensor is beautiful. It's obviously not as user-friendly, but it's in terms of looking at a print on like an A4 sheet of paper, it's as good as modern cameras. And the color science is beautiful, I thought. But live view, not so great on a CCD. It's this like weird green pixel.
Live view is not live. It's more like stop motion
with a lot of
artifacts.
Trying to focus like a bellows system with one of those, just go back to the ground glass, and then you had the little slidey thing, didn't you, to pull it back into place again. But of course, it was slightly off because there was a gap between the glass and the sensor. So it was a nightmare.
Despite everything we chatted about, there was something that LSDG forgot to mention, which is the LSDG iPad Pro cheese plate system. For those who don't know what a cheese plate is, it's how you attach everything to everything. It's like the Swiss Army knife of connectors. Now, since the iPad Pro's release, they've been used more and more on sets, either for Capture Live with the Studio app, which is the sort of the better version of Capture Pilot now, or to shoot directly to them because they do have the USB-C port. So this lets you attach everything to one place, make it a highly functional, movable, and also more secure bit of kit for your iPad, because they are expensive and you don't want them going flying. So you can either have it yourself as like a holdable monitor, or you can attach it to your entire digital setup.
So big thanks to today's sponsors, Fujifilm, for just making this whole thing possible. As I'm sure you're all well aware, I shoot with Fujifilm, and LSDG, and I'm still not risking saying his name and getting it wrong, like I know I will, works with a lot of Fujifilm shooters, because it is the bigger than full frame. You've got the X series color options. It's just bang for buck. it's a no-brainer, and it is taking over the commercial photography industry. For years, it would have been a full-frame camera, and for those who are absolutely minted, some sort of large sensor. But now it is a similar price point to full-frame, but bigger. And it's very hard to argue with those.
No, numbers are numbers, and the bigger than full frame thing is important from not just the resolution point of view, but everything is bigger. Like your bit depth is better, your skin tones are better, the color science is better. It is definitely an upgrade, not just a newer, fancier version of what you already own.
Exactly. And I think going full frame to full frame, it's very difficult to see anything. Going full frame to bigger than full frame, you see the difference. And it's professional. And I know that... you can get a great picture on an iPhone, for sure. Let's not, that's not up for debate. But you get a better picture on a better camera. There's an expectation when you're shooting a worldwide campaign that you're not rocking up with a full frame and you're rocking up with something bigger than full frame.
Yeah, there's the expectation plus, where is that image likely to end up? And this is always the important thing that we discuss ahead of every shoot, is if you're putting something on Instagram, most cameras are indistinguishable between modern smartphones, I think it's probably fair to say, on the gram.
Yeah, pretty much.
Now, if you're on a 200-foot billboard in Times Square, that's a very different level.
Yeah, and also the people who are signing it off have a different level of scrutiny. Like your local law firm, they don't care. Like if they look good, they look good. But when it's going to like a top ad agency in the world, I get asked, why didn't you shoot that in medium format? And they can tell. I don't know, because I didn't have one, because it was too expensive back then. Yeah,
there's a number of small quantifiable things, but it's the look.
Yeah.
You just know, and as you found out from your recent portrait shoots, there's something almost three-dimensional that you just don't get from a full-frame camera.
Exactly, yeah. The bigger the sensor, the better the image, basically. But with that comes the price of money. So it's finding that sweet spot. And I think the reason why the Fujifilm cameras are so, especially the GFX, is so popular in our industry is because it is bigger, but it's not like horrifically expensive like other options may be.
No, I mean, the value for money is undeniable, let's be honest.
I'm all about value for money.
I mean, times are tough out there.
Times are tough everywhere right now.
Can't be throwing 100 Gs around on other things. There's that. And I think that, an important thing is you've always stressed from day one the importance of doing test shoots and doing your own work. Now, it's not always feasible to rent the top of the line esoteric cameras every time you want to do a test shoot.
Exactly.
That starts to get very expensive very quickly.
Yeah.
Whereas I think for the value proposition of the GFX, you should own that and shoot with it regularly.
Yeah, this is something we haven't touched on before, but I was always very much of the belief that I would never own a medium format camera because I can't justify that price point being sat in my studio for most of the year doing nothing. But now I can. It's actually a very similar price point to what I would have spent on a non-medium format.
Yeah, very similar to what you were shooting with previously. The retail costs.
A big thank you to Fujifilm for sponsoring this and for creating the camera that means I can afford to say, I shoot medium format and sound like an absolute boss.
Yeah.
All right, let's dive back into the interview.
So what's your setup now? I mean, I follow you on Instagram, mostly because I like looking at your setup. It's always very, I like the way that everything's perfect. Like everything is like got its
Thank
place
you.
And it's all, that's what, no, I mean, it, oh, excuse me, I about to sneeze then. If you're going to have a Digitech, you want an organized Digitech because that is the name of the game really, isn't it? So what's your setup now? If you were going to come on a shoot for a stills campaign and video campaign, what would you be bringing?
So for the still setup, I mean, on every shoot, I'll have my innovative cart. So on most studio shoots, I use the Voyager 36 innovative cart, which for me, I think it's the ultimate in terms of versatility. It's got, a good amount of space. I put a middle shelf on there. I've got an amazing monitor system made by Upgrade Innovations, which is a really good Canadian company, which I highly rate. I mean, I talk about them probably every other day on my stories because I own almost everything on their catalog. And my main monitor, I think, on the cart is a 31-inch 4K ISO, which works really well. It's a really big screen, so it means that people, you know, even further away from me, behind me, can see the image. There's a lot of space for me to organize my windows, and it's just really beautiful to look at as well. And then most of the packages, I mean, I have at least one satellite monitor. So that means it's a 4K ISO that's on a rolling stand. And it also has a 15-meter extension, which is like a really kind of nicely homemade braided cable, which has DisplayPort, USB, and power. So it's really easy to, you know, move around. It can be next to the photographer. If the photographer doesn't need it, it can be next to the client. And then if it's a bigger shoot, you know, we can have as many monitors as we need. You know, we can have another for the clients. We can have, quite often I now do wireless video villages, especially for the time when we do TVCs alongside motion. Yeah. So we, you know, the video village might be like 30 meters away from where the stills are shot. So there is kind of no cable that can go as far as you need it to be. Plus it's going to be, you know, in the way, people are going to be tripping up on it. So that's when video transmission comes in really handy. So I'll have like a 4K Teradek set up, you know, in different places. It could be one or two places, you know, one for client, maybe one for agency or something like that, just so everybody can see it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I looked at these carts you're talking about. I was like, those carts look perfect. I'm going to get one. And then I saw the price tag and I was like, no, I'm not. We'll stick to my cheap rock and roller that does literally rock and roll when you move it around. For my like in studio one, obviously when we go away, we rent those, but they're very good, but
they are really good and they're definitely not the cheapest things. I mean, I think I got, it wasn't the very first one that I bought in London, but I was maybe the first Digi that bought one in London. And when I did, I think people are like, who is this crazy guy buying this like $3,500 car? Like, no one's going to rent it. And yeah, initially it was obviously hard because I was still, you know, quite young and sort of getting into it and stuff. But now, honestly, every single shoot, I will have the cart. Like, there's a handful of jobs which were probably location jobs that I didn't have it. It's just such an amazing tool, whether it, you know, it doesn't just help like on set. You know, you can move between two different sets. You can be super portable, but also it just kind of helps me as well to pack down because, you know, I now have a van with a fixed sort of folding ramp, which means that I can keep the cart fully built up. And I just pack the computers, the monitors down, put it, stack it on the cart, wheel it into the van, and then on the other side, wheel it back into my office.
Yeah.
And that is, it's such a game changer. It's been huge in terms of saving time and just saving my back as well. I think, when you're getting a little bit older, you're like, you lift the screen, you're like, ooh, that hurt.
Cause I mean, it's heavy kit, isn't it? The monitors, especially. And then in terms of computing things, computers, that's the word I'm looking for.
Yes.
what computers are you using to power all this tethering and DITing?
Yeah. So for studio shoots, I use an M1 Studio Ultra. So it's a fully spec'd out Mac Studio. It sounds like it's quite old because obviously we have M4 laptops out now. I think maybe M2 Studio's out, but it is so fast. Even I think just now Capture One just released an update, which I'm allowed to talk about. The processing speed of the M1, I believe, don't quote me on this, but it's still faster to process TIFFs and JPEGs on the M1 Studio than it is on an M4 laptop, because now Capture One are utilizing the cores, the GPU, significantly more efficiently, which means that, you know, the studios do have more cores and, you know, both CPU and GPU. So it's still king after all these years. You know, back in the day, I used to be buying a new laptop almost every single year because, you know, oh, the battery life is so much better. Oh, it's so much faster. And now, you know, I'm not spending as much money. I'm I still have an M2 laptop for location work, and it's ridiculously fast. I still use it for my DIT workflows. I mean, yesterday I was on a shoot with a mini LF. We were shooting RE RAW, and it was transcoding at like 75 frames a second. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's and the so price fast. Point of these computers now. We went for the M1s as soon as they came out. And I remember thinking, oh, I should have got a higher spec machine than I bought. And I'm still using it today. And we edit 6K raw video footage on it all the time without problems. Yeah. And it cost me, I can't remember, but it wasn't much compared to what it would have cost me 5 years ago to get something that could do this job. And is there a particular reason why you use Mac and not PC?
So prior to getting into photography, I was super into PCs. Like I said, you know, I love the modular aspect of it, you know, being able to upgrade the graphics card and the RAM and, you know, changing everything up. And I was so into it. But I also recognized that I was wasting so much time, like the amount of time that I was spending on maintaining the computer to work correctly, you know, upgrading, I can't even remember at this point, like framework or whatever it was, defragmenting disks. And there was all this kind of stuff. And then I used a Mac in college and I was like, wow, this is easy. And it kind of works. And it's strange. And I mean, now in 15 years of doing this job, I have never seen a PC on set. It's not a thing in the commercial market. Like, I don't know. I mean, I know many digis around the world, and I don't really know a single one that, you know, hires out a PC. I think people would just be like, what is this?
Yeah.
It's just not a, yeah.
I mean, even things like Capture Pilot, I think it's only Mac compatible, isn't it? Like, and Capture One is the only software I've seen on set.
Yeah, I don't actually know about Pilot. It's a good question. I mean, like I said, I never thought about PC actually for so many years now.
Yeah, I'm sure if you've got like an Android phone or an Android tablet, you can't have Capture Pilot on it.
Oh, you might have a point. Yeah, because even
I might be wrong,
like,
actually. I don't know. Yeah.
What's it called? Life for Studio, which is the new Capture One kind of edition. And I believe that is also just on the App Store. Hopefully, I'm not wrong. Yes.
Yeah, I had a call with Capture One a couple of weeks ago, actually, from the new CEO guy, whose name I've completely forgotten.
Raphael,
that's it. I know he had a very cool name. I was like, you sound like a cool dude. He had a standing desk and everything. You know he's cool when he's got, I bet he's got a treadmill under there. But yeah, he was showing me some of the new things in Capture One. And I was like, brilliant. I'm going to forget about this in about 5 seconds, but thank you for telling me. some new, like...
There's a lot of new updates, actually. I mean, they have been kind of rolling them out quite quickly. I mean, as of the last couple of years, last year or so since Raphael came in, I mean, there was a big kind of shakeup in the company. I don't know if you remember, but there was like a big revolt against Capture One in the digi community when they took out the export tab or something.
And yeah, but they didn't even warn anybody. Everyone updated it and went, what, how?
Yeah, how do I process an image? I think that was like a sort of like a, I mean, they openly talk about it now, honestly. Like, I've had many meetings with Capture One, and they really recognize that moment as being quite a key moment in that they changed the way that they communicate. So now we have like a Discord group with other digis who are, you know, beta testing. We're feeding them feedback, ideas, how can we improve things. They are having Zoom meetings with us every month. I mean, I have probably had 3 meetings in the last month, I think, with Capture One, in terms of like, hey, how does this work? See these new features, tell us what you think of it. And they're really trying to get in touch with the people that are using it in the most kind of intense way. Because I guess, you know, digis and big advertising photographers are a relatively small market for Capture One, I would imagine. You know, I'm sure that the biggest market is probably, you know, portrait photographers, wedding photographers, you know, amateur photographers and so on. But obviously they might not be using the software to such an extreme, you know, they're not pushing the boundaries as far as we are when it comes to, you know, processing, you know, 3,000 TIFFs and, you know, doing, you know, color grading.
The fans
doing
going
multiple,
off in the background, yeah.
Yeah, you know, we push the software to its extremes, I think. And they're actually being really cool at interacting with us and asking us questions and really quickly fixing problems.
Yeah, they do seem very awesome. Honest. I brought up an issue with them. I was like, if Live View is open in Capture One on a separate screen and the Digi presses the fire camera button with the mouse, it freezes with a Fuji GFX. And they're like, we did not know that. I was like, it's a bit of a niche scenario, but that's what happens.
Yeah. I mean, there's many niche scenarios, you know, that we all come across, but it's that kind of a thing where I read a lot of, you know, Reddit and Discord and, you know, forums where people kind of talk about issues, but a lot of those issues don't end up being reported properly. And then nobody will know about it. Like, I think I reported this bug where I think, let's say you have multiple favorite folders in Capture One and it's set on, let's say, shot one, and you're trying to rename shot two. So you're in the middle of typing something different. And if a photographer takes a photo, it merges both of the folders with the same name, and you click both and they're both the same, but nothing makes sense.
Yeah.
So I think I reported it, and I've been dealing with this issue, I don't know how many years. And I've just like lived around it. And I don't know why. And then probably like a couple of weeks ago, I just said it on the Discord. I was like, hey guys, just to let you know, there's this bug. And they were like, cool, we'll fix it. Like, because nobody reported it. And it's kind of my own fault as well for not doing it. And I just lived with it.
Yeah, it was the same. And he literally had some guys from the company, like the tech guys, email me going, can you please do the following? Send this log file to us after it happens and like
logs,
if it happens, send
logs
over.
Yes.
And yeah, they're like, brilliant, we'll update you as soon as we've got it sorted. I'm like, oh, nice. Because every time I would go, because I'll be focusing on one monitor with Live View on, the Digi will be doing something. The client might go, can we just get a frame of that? They'll press the button and I'm like, great, let's restart everything. We've killed it. I don't know if it's fixed or not. Yeah, I'll have to look at the new update. But I was going to say, one of the things that I use your Instagram account for is we don't update anything until we see that you've done it. Well, like, has it been updated in LSDG yet? Let's see. And if it has, does he have good things to say about it, or do we hang fire for a bit?
I mean, it's funny. Back in the day, you would absolutely not upgrade to the next Capture One until everyone kind of says it. But I think these days for me is not upgrading the OS, because for me the thing that breaks everything the most is when, you know, Apple launches a keynote and then everyone's like, oh my god, you know, OS whatever 16 or whatever it is now, I can't remember, quickly download it, and then they download it and then they try to launch Capture One or Photoshop or something and doesn't work. And it's like, well, yes, it's been announced 30 seconds ago. Don't do that.
Yeah. I made that mistake once just before a shoot. We updated the computers and I didn't know about these sorts of issues. Tried to open Capture One, wouldn't launch. Tried to open Lightroom. I was like, oh, thank God Lightroom opens. Went to tether in Lightroom, wouldn't tether. I was like, great. Yeah. So we ended up shooting to the Canon EOS utility onto a file on the desktop to automatically read that file in Lightroom and open it into Lightroom. And the stress,
the old school hot folder.
Yeah, I was like, oh my God, this is so stressful. But we made it through. Now speaking of cameras and things, what is your favorite and least favorite camera to work with on a purely usability and functionality basis? Like, what is the simplest camera to use?
I really like the R5, the Canon R5.
Yep.
We use it a lot in one of my kind of regular jobs, and it's bulletproof. Like, we use that thing, you know, 1 week at a time, you know, shooting nonstop. It doesn't break. The focus is incredible. You know, I might delete like one or two frames a day at that point. It's reliable. It works really well. It's quick to render on Capture One. Also, the Nikons, I think, are also great. I don't use them as much, but I have a few clients with like Z7s, Z9s, and they're also, I think, amazing cameras at the moment. I mean, they're probably two of my favorites to sort of use. As for least favorites, that's a tough question. I'd probably maybe say Sony's for the menus, because their menu systems are intense. And Tether used to be quite problematic, especially when you hire a Sony, you had to like enable two different settings in two different places on the menu to then be able to tether to Capture One. I mean, maybe things have changed since then, but yeah, that's probably one of my least favorites.
I remember with the Phase Ones back in the day when you had it was before the Phase One bodies, you had the Mamiya DF body and a Phase One back. And every now and again, you had to disconnect the cable, restart the computer, take the battery out, take the back off, put the back on, put the battery back on, just to get it to work again. And I was like, yeah, but the 5D Mark II just stays tethered. We'll just use that.
it's funny how many problems we used to have. I mean, I'm sure you can probably look back on your career and remember like Capture One 6 or 5 or something. I mean, when I started, we used to have so many tether issues, and they were like kind of like nonsensical, where it's like everything's working, nothing changed, it stopped working. And then, you know, it's just such a muscle memory at this point of like, you know, unplugging the cable, taking the battery out, restarting Capture One, restarting the computer. It's like, we don't really need to do that anymore.
No, it's kind of nice. It's much more reliable nowadays. Yeah, I do remember.
People are kind of spoiled.
Oh, God, yeah, so much easier. I remember being on a job in Paris, and we'd rented the computers and we'd rented the cameras. And I was on the phone to this Parisian rental center in my bad French. And I was like, nothing is working. We've got four cables, two computers, two cameras, nothing. And they're just like, yeah, it happens. I'm like, no, it doesn't happen. Hey.
Shoot a card.
Yeah, that's what we ended up doing in the end. And then we're like taking one card out, uploading that whilst the second card went in, and carrying on shooting. I was like, oh my God, this is awful.
Oh yeah.
What's your favorite and least favorite current camera for image quality? Like, what produces the nicest files at the moment? Like, money be damned.
You know what? That's such an interesting question, because I think back then I could answer it much easier. I think these days, I think that the sensor technology is so good that I can't say like, oh, Canon is superior to Nikon, or, you know, Phase One is superior to Fuji or something. I mean, yes, it all has, you know, slightly different skin tones, things like that. But as far as quality goes, I mean, you can shoot on a Fuji and get great images. You can shoot on a Sony and get great images. I think it's now much less about what is the best quality camera, but what the photographer is most comfortable using.
Yeah.
Because I think what you don't want is to have a camera in your hands that you're like, this is weird. The focusing is, you know, not right for this job. Because you can do a job where you shoot in a car and you don't need a camera that has an incredible autofocus system. You just need a camera that can take a really good photo. Whereas you might be on a you know, a lifestyle job. Where, I mean, back in the day, we shot lifestyle with, you know, IQ250s and, you know, P45s, and it was like, oh, out of focus. Oh, out of focus. That's a great shot, but it's not in focus.
It's not in focus.
Use it. And it was such a struggle. And because, you know, an art director, a client said that they need X amount of megapixels, which is sort of a lie. I mean, we've all done billboard campaigns on 18 megapixel cameras. Like, you know, it can be done. We don't all need 150 megapixels for every single job, I think. So it's definitely, it's more of a tool, the right tool for that specific job and what feels the best in your hands, I would say.
Yeah, I definitely say that there's not great advances in image quality at the moment. It's all good. Like, there's preferences.
It's
like,
all good.
I like a bigger sensor. My researcher likes more megapixels, because he says he can zoom in and do, like, when he's got to do horrific pen tool work, he went, if there's more megapixels, my life's better. I'm like, cool, if that's what you like, I don't care. Like whether it's 20 or 150, it looks the same to my eyes. I can't see the difference, but if it's good for retouching, it's good for retouching. You know, but then it also says sometimes it's a hazard for retouching because it's just a little bit too much information. And it's got to get rid of it.
Yeah, I guess for people it's a bit different. It's like, why is it so sharp?
Please,
you put some filters on. I mean, we're putting filters on quite often these days for like fashion campaigns and stuff. I mean, digital files are now so sharp and so, you know, amazing quality that you actually need to tone it down. So we end up putting... you know, Hollywood filters or whatever.
Yeah,
just to
I don't remember the last time we sharpened an image in post, because we used to sharpen them in post for sure. We still bang some clarity on for some of the still life stuff because it looks cool, but not for a detail, for an aesthetic look more than anything. Do you notice any trends in like what the most popular camera is at the moment on set? Like what's is it like something like, oh, pretty much everyone's using this right now?
I'd say it's between, I mean, personally, in between the R5 and the Fujis.
Yeah.
I think the Fuji GFX series has meant, you know, that has brought the prices down to enter the medium format world. And I think more and more photographers now are buying them and using them. So, you know, but there was a time when photographers kind of stopped buying cameras almost. They were just hiring. But I think now a lot of photographers own their own, you know, GFX 100 or, you know, another camera, and they kind of bring it to set.
And then charge the client the rental thing. That's what I've been doing.
Indeed. It's a tool.
could pay the rental fee or could own it because it is so cheap to own a GFX now. It's like, it's not that much more than a R5.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Obviously the lenses become expensive because they're big lenses.
Yes.
And the file,
but you can
storage.
Hire the lenses as well.
Yeah, lens rental is
part,
cheap.
Right?
It's like £20 a lens.
Cheap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same with lights. Lights are really cheap to rent. I'm always shocked that you can like, to rent a £3,000 camera is quite expensive. To rent a £12,000 Broncolor pack is £50. I'm like, make it
it's
make sense.
It's pretty crazy, isn't it? I've always wondered that. Plus they do go wrong as well. I mean, I've heard a lot of Pro 10 packs explode and... It seems like a hefty investment.
Yeah, we've destroyed a lot of pro photo gear over the years. I don't know whether it gets ragged more than Broncolor gear. Like, we've never had Broncolor gear like explode, but pro photo stuff, just you hear a loud pop and a little puff of smoke and it's like, oops, what did we do there? Although I do shoot everything on full power, so that probably doesn't help matters, but
yeah, that's a lot of power going through.
Yeah, it's like 10 packs on full whack. This is not on my questions, but I've just thought of it because that is an annoying trait I have. What are the most annoying traits that photographers have from a Digitex point of view? What do we do that you're just like, oh, for God's sake, not you. Don't do that.
Oh, wow. That's a great question. And I'm like really trying to...
Are we just so varied in our stupidity? Like, I'm... Because I know that my editor, for example, will be like, Scott, next time you make this decision, please phone me first. I'm like, sorry about that. It's like, because we could have done this a lot quicker had you not done it this way. I'm like, yeah, sorry. Is it?
Sorry. I try not to tell off my photographers too much. I really can't think of anything. I mean, I'll keep trying and I might get back to you.
Yeah. I mean, you must have seen things go catastrophically wrong on set. Like, I mean, I had a robot once smash through a table just before the last shot of the day. And I was like, great. No one panic. you must see some pretty funny things happen. And
I mean, I guess the thing for me probably is just how photographers deal with their crew, because, you know, you have some photographers who are, you know, very respectful and really nice, and then you have some photographers with, you know, certain egos that end up lashing out at their assistants and stuff. I mean, that probably for me is the only thing, I reckon.
Yeah, I've heard stories of that. Like, I mean, yeah. I was perhaps a bit cranky in my early days when I perhaps felt like I had something to prove. But I mean, I've worked with the same assistant my entire career. And I was actually his assistant before he was my assistant. In a weird, I don't know, that happens very often. But he didn't like shooting. He didn't like the stress anymore. So he just assists.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely found myself, I wasn't as much as a tyrant of what I've heard from other people, but I was definitely heading in that direction. And it was definitely me feeling insecure, which created that personality trait. Whereas now, I don't know, I'm pretty chill, I think. Probably gone too far the other way, but it's I've heard some hilarious stories of like photographers' assistants being fired and kicked off set because they didn't burst all the bubbles in a cup of tea around the rim. Like with someone's the limit, and they've just, I don't know if you've heard these ones.
Like, I mean, there's many stories, and you know, which includes violence.
Yeah,
it's quite shocking, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, this happens much less these days. I think, you know, back in the 90s, back in the noughties, you know, that was allowed.
Yeah, definitely.
To be a thing.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it was also accepted by the, like, if I kicked off on a set today, that client's never working with me again. Guarantee it. Like, there's no, and same with like turning up drunk on set. Like, we heard some stories last week about a particular shoot where the entire team turned up stoned and like barely able to move.
Wow.
And I'm like, you're just like, why would you, like, you could have done that in the 90s and everyone would be like, oh, the creatives. But now it's like, what are you doing?
I mean, the market's changed. There's obviously like a lot more photographers, and you know, why would you work with someone that is an asshole, right? Even as a client, I guess, because you still have to deal with the photographer, right?
Oh god, yeah. It's,
so it's, you know, you could either choose this person or another person who's super lovely, super, you know, treats you well. You can see they treat their team well. Everyone has a great time. And, you know, we're not, this isn't surgery. I think that's the one thing that sometimes I've been on shoots where people sometimes take it so serious to the point where, you know, they get so stressed and, you know, nasty. And you just think, this isn't brain surgery. You know, we're making really cool pictures. Really, you know, beautiful pictures, cool pictures. We're going to sell some stuff, right? We're here to, you know, make some money and, you know, help ourselves and help, you know, the company and the clients we work for.
Have a good time. We've chosen this job because it's fun.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think a lot of people forget that, don't they? They get all caught up in it and, you know, it becomes this. I mean, it is a stressful job. But I mean, one of the things I learned quite early was the main aim of a shoot is for the client to have a good time, because anybody can take the photograph. And I know this because I was very humbled early in my career. I went to the bathroom for an extended break and I came back and one of the shots had been taken and signed off without me even being in the room. I was like, oh, nice one. Great. That is perfect. And I was like, Jesus Christ, I might have needed her. But the client had such a good time. We've worked with them for the last 10 years. You know,
we
make sure it's like a party on set. You know, obviously some shoots go horrifically wrong and they're stressful, but even then you've got to make sure that it's like, don't worry, we've got it. Like, it's like reaching into your own pocket going like, how much is overtime, everybody? but yes, so what I'd like to chat to you about now is your wares, which is how we spoke originally, is because I think I bought some cables or a cable from you.
Yeah, so I started selling Area 51 tether cables. And back then that was kind of the first alternative to tether tools.
Yep.
And it was, you know, it was kind of a big shift in trends, I suppose, because it was probably the first cable that was 10 meters that worked.
Yeah, you could buy 10 meter cables.
You could join them and it wouldn't, you know, you'd have troubles.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I kind of started selling that, and I really liked it because it was, the company's owned by another digi who works in New York, and I was like, I'd love to support him. You know, it's I think it's nice to take care of each other.
And they are brilliant cables. They gave me some free ones a few years ago, and I was like, these are good. And I remember, and I probably shouldn't, no, I think I can say this now, I'm never going to work with them again. I was doing a job for Tether Tools, and we couldn't get my cameras to tether with their cables. I was sat there, I was like, I've got another cable in my bag. Like, what color is it? I was like, it's red. They're like, no. I was like, okay, but currently your cables do not work. I was like, They're just,
I mean, they're opening there.
Pack after pack of cake. We eventually found one that worked. And I was just like, oh, I felt so, I'd already agreed to the job and it was like a live talk and everything on a stage.
Yeah, I was just
like, oh my God, this is like,
that's a lot of pressure.
I was like, here I am telling everyone these cables are good and we just had to open all these packs to find them. And I felt really, like, this isn't like toy with a lot because there are a lot of sponsorship deals. But I had, up until USB-C, always used Tether Tools. And until USB-C, Tether Tools always worked. And then USB-C came along and it was like, well, that doesn't work anymore. I don't know what happened there, but...
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I had a similar experience as well. I mean, but Tether cables is such a funny thing because... You know, they do get so abused on set.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you think of buying a HDMI cable, you will plug into your TV or whatever, and it will never be touched again for, you know, 5 years, whatever. And it works. But tether cables, I mean, they get stood on, you know, heavy stands get pushed on, you know, things, you know, people trip up on them. It's one of those things. I mean, obviously, like I sell Area 51 cables and stuff, but you know, sometimes they die, you know, even
like
for
an
me,
iPhone, it's like, charger, isn't it? You constantly bending it and stretching it and you're
constantly
doing
it.
And, like, oh, I need a new phone charger.
I know. And it's one of those, I think, expected things where like you buy a cable, you're like, oh, that's going to work for me for like 10 years. It's like, no, I've had cables which lasted me a month maybe because, you know, they got submerged in water. We were shooting in the lake. I still have a cable that has lasted me well over a year because it's still USB-A on one side and I use a dongle. And it's the same cable I use on almost every single shoot. And it still works. And I refuse to like change. I'm like, nope, still works.
Yeah, it's still working. We'll get gamma. Because they're not cheap, but tether cables. Because no, I get people going, oh, you can get the same cable for £20. I'm like, no. You can get a cable for £20, but it is not the same cable. And it works until it doesn't. I mean, I don't know if you've heard of the company Cobra Tether.
Yeah, I do, of course.
I bought one of their long cables because I assumed it was a rebadged Area 51. It was not.
It
didn't work. It was intermittent and, you know, it was a 10-meter cable, but it was much cheaper. And I was like, cheaper is good. At the moment. I had a bad experience with their long cable, but their short cable is really good. Okay. But now we'll just stick to Area 51 because I've never bought from Area 51 and gone, this isn't good. It just seems to work, which is obviously what you want, like, you know, a tethering cable.
For sure. Yeah. And you don't want it going down, obviously.
No, and always having a spare, brand new, unopened Area 51 cable in my bag, which is like, if this one dies, we pull out the brand new one because, and I don't have two running at any time because I just want to know that one is box fresh and like good to go should it go horrifically wrong.
It's a very good tactic. Yeah. I mean, on every shoot, I come with too many tether cables. I must have like 10 sets or something of like every, you know, USB C to C, C to B.
Yeah.
You know, every time
you must
cable,
be like, well, I have no idea
case.
What's going to be needed. So you know, just bring
yeah,
the whole
and sometimes you
sink.
Don't. I mean, quite often I'm booked on a job and I turn up and they're like, hey, have you brought a tether cable for like an old phase back? It's like, oh, I wasn't told, but hey, here is a cable and we can go.
I always have every cable I need for the shoot, even though we end up using the Digitex cables, just because I'm just like, but what if they don't have, like, obviously everyone's got a USB-C to USB-C, but like, what if they haven't? What if they've assumed that I'm bringing it, even though we've said this and, you know, all the, like, it's never happened, but I worry. Right. So I bring like all the cables,
it's a good
I bring
thing
my
to be
own
worried.
Hard drives
yeah.
and they just sit in the bag. I'm like, oh, we didn't need them again. Never mind. It's like, we'll keep bringing them. So apart from the cables, which obviously stock in the UK, do you ship globally or UK only?
No, globally, to be honest, I ship a lot to the EU as well. When it comes to cables, I mean, I also design and make other stuff. Like I started making accessories for the DigiPlate, which has become kind of like an industry standard, I'd say, in like higher end shoots. Most Digis, a lot of photographers also have them now. And I just found like a gap in the market because I think when I opened up my little online shop and I had one product, I was probably the first Digi that was selling 3D printed stuff back then. So it was quite early on. And now there's many, you know, more digis, more companies and stuff selling them as well. But I kind of like recognize a gap in the market because you have this plate, you know, the laptop plate, and underneath, I always struggled like where to place my hard drives or how to mount it to an Arca Swiss tripod, but also I'd like it to go on a baby pin, for example. Various uses that I needed, but it didn't exist. And I think I started the first thing that I was really proud of that I made was a digi base adapter. So it's a very small metal piece that screws into the digi plate, and it has an inbuilt Arca Swiss, like a, you know, like a rail.
Yep.
And underneath it also has a baby pin adapter. And it was, I initially bought the innovative one, and it was one or the other. To use it on an Arca Swiss, you had to screw in the plate. But then if you screw in the plate, you can't put it on a lighting stand, for example, or whatever. And then if you twist it, it sort of untwists. And I was like, and it also, if you use the digi legs and you put it on the table, it rocks. Because guess what? They sort of didn't plan the two together to be used and put on the table. And I was like, how can I do this differently? So I ended up shrinking its size, creating the, you know, integrated Arca rail. And that's probably even to this day, actually, is the most popular thing that I still sell. But amongst that, I mean, I do lots of like SSD caddies, like little attachments for USB-C docks, for various adapters. I mean, I don't know, I must have maybe 30 or so different things currently on my website.
It's amazing how often like we're rigging something up in the studio. And it's like, you end up with like, even with Kate, I was like, have I got two female ends? And I need to, I'm like, what? What's
how do you join this together?
Yeah, I'm sat there. Normally shouting. I'm like, Rob, I've got this here and this here, but they need to attach. But there's nothing left to screw together without it. And he's like, yeah, you know, that doesn't work. I was like, I can see that, but can you make it work without gaffer tape?
I think that's kind of how it started. I mean, I love digi grip. There isn't a department. There's a grip department. There isn't really a digi grip department, but I kind of wish there was because I'd love that. I mean, I love mounting things, coming up ways of mounting new things or...
Do you have cup holders on the go?
Robocups, everywhere.
Yeah,
I have at least two on every car.
What's your punishment for someone who put... I don't know if you're the same as everyone else's, but if someone puts a drink on your digicar, what do you do to that person?
they go on my Instagram highlights called Shelf of Shame.
Yeah.
so I zoom into the sticker on my cart which says no food or drink. Yeah. And then I zoom into the cup of coffee right next to my keyboard and tag the photographers.
I remember we had a stylist who kept putting their drink on the digi cart she'd been told so many times. And eventually the Digitech just started pouring. She got a bin, like a solid bin. Every time they would drink one, they just poured it straight into the bin and put the empty cup back down. She didn't seem to cotton on at all, but like it was good natured about it. He saw the funny side now, I think, after a while.
Yeah.
Yes.
I feel like maybe the culture's changed now because sometimes I see people coming over to me, putting a cup and then going, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I'm like, hey, it's cool. It's all good. But, you know, they almost like they have been maybe told off by somebody else before me.
Maybe that's what's happening. Everybody else is, and they're losing their rag at people. Yeah, going, God!
You'll see massive egos, you know, cups thrown across on the you know studio floors, and maybe that's happening behind my back. Who knows?
Yeah, but no, I do love a good. I have my own little C stand with a little plate on it with my iPad for capture, and I've got a little RoboCup thing, and it's got you know water in one and Diet Coke in the other. Because once I've like reached my coffee limit for the day, I switched to Diet Coke to keep the caffeine high, but without the sugar rush. Oh, Teddy's joining the corner of the call as well.
I know, I just got
he's been out playing with his fellow golden retrievers this morning, so he's pretty exhausted. He's just rolling around to have new sleeping spots. But no, I mean, I love all the like rigging of stuff. We'll pop a link down to your shop below in the notes. Because I think I go down a rabbit hole with looking at digi grip. Because I love grip. Like I love any way that you can rig something nicely. Yeah. And you know, I all of that sort of stuff. And I'm actually just looking at my monitor here, talking about cups. I've got do not touch labeled on every single monitor.
Amazing. I mean, I also have the same thing, but I somewhat feel like it's an encouragement for art directors and clients to touch it.
The worst is when they get a pen out and start tapping them off. I'm like, imagine how expensive that is. Please put the pen away.
I once had somebody point a scalpel at my screen. I didn't say anything, but I kind of breathed in and was just ready for my screen to be destroyed. Luckily, it was fine. But that really happens. Yeah.
Oh, well, the thing I've discovered is, though, that the person who is touching my monitors is actually me. I was like, how are their fingerprints? I was like, that was me. That was absolutely me.
Yeah.
But yeah, amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time today. It's greatly appreciated. I'm just wondering, do you have any advice? I'm going to put you right on the spot here so we can cut out any thinking time if we need to. Any advice for photographers for how they can be better with their, because most of them won't have Digitex, how they can be better with their workflow, their like digital life. What's the number one bit of advice you'd give them?
Good question. I mean, maybe like stuff like creating the session folders and the folders maybe the day before the shoot. You know, if they don't have the extra help, I think just coming prepared, you know, Chronosync Windows maybe already pre-configured. I mean, because I used to shoot as well a little bit, and that's what I used to do. Like, because I couldn't book a digi either, so I would set the digi up so I open the laptop and everything is ready. And that minimizes risks, you know, and minimizes stress on the day. I guess just maybe even asking, you know, more questions, forums. I think, you know, Capture One, Reddit, and I also created a Reddit group called Photo Assistance, which is, it's huge now. I think it must be like over 1,500 members. It's become a much bigger thing. I thought it might be just like 15 people, like, you know, us nerdy digis speaking to each other. But it became much bigger than I expected. And I think it's a very useful pool of information because people talk about all sorts of issues, you know, from tethering to cameras to, you know, Capture One to computers and lighting as well. Actually, is a lot of the talk is kind of, you know, how to light this portrait or, you know, what to use, what kit to use and stuff. Just kind of learning from online resources.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing. I think there's so much information out there online nowadays. It's so easy to learn a bit, but to learn it fully is a different thing. But it's easier to get going nowadays than it ever has been. Like to get up and running and like get the basics in. There's no excuse. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.